Thank you, Lord. We commit our ways to you. Amen. This passage from the book of Jethro, or this essay, I should say, citing the sounds, includes a couple of very interesting statements. This essay is a little longer than the ones we've been reading. I don't always go with the shortest of the essays, but tend to pick those that aren't too long. Some of them are, you know, 8 to 10 pages long, so I tend to skip over those, although they're interesting. This one's called Citing the Sounds, and it starts, "All the people saw the sounds and the flames and the mountain smoking. The people saw and trembled and stood afar off." This is from Exodus chapter 20, verse 15. It's 18 in the NIV, but 15 in the Jewish translation of the text, or that's the way it's numbered in a Jewish text. But you can see something odd about this phrase, and this is what the essay is about. But I've mentioned this many times: when the Hebrew describes something awkwardly or in a way that it isn't intended to, it's significant of a great insight, right? So we don't see sounds. We hear sounds. We don't hear sights. We see sights. But in this passage, the verbs and the objects are kind of mixed up, right? So that we see the sounds and hear the sights. Rabbi Ishmael says they saw what is seen and heard what is heard. Rabbi Akiva says they saw what is heard and heard what is seen. Right? So Akiva, there's going to be an interesting discussion between these two rabbis on this particular issue, but it makes for an interesting discussion. 33 centuries ago, the entire Jewish nation witnessed the revelation of God at Mount Sinai. Centuries later, two Talmudic sages, Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Ishmael, offered somewhat differing accounts of the experience. One difference between them concerns the manner in which the revelation at Sinai was perceived by our senses. After recounting the proclamation of the Ten Commandments at Sinai, the Torah relates, "All the people saw the sounds and the flames and the mountain smoking. The people saw and trembled and stood afar." What does it mean that they saw the sounds? According to Rabbi Akiva, the manner in which we perceived the sights and sounds at Sinai was radically different from the way in which stimuli are ordinarily assimilated, right? And this is what I'm referring to, just the juxtaposition of these expressions suggests that there's something particular about this text that is that its importance is more broad than the surface level interpretation would suggest. At Sinai, our senses of sight and hearing reversed their roles. We saw what is ordinarily heard and heard what is ordinarily seen. Not so, says Rabbi Ishmael, at Sinai, we experienced the greatest divine revelation of all time in the same manner in which we ordinarily relate to reality. We saw what is seen and heard what is heard. According to Rabbi Ishmael, the word saw in the verse refers to the flames and the smoking mountain mentioned later in the sentence. Right? So it's interesting the way these two rabbis understand what is being said in the text. But both interpretations of this verse raise as many questions as they answer. regarding Rabbi Akiva's description of an extraordinary transmutation of our senses, we can ask, amazing, but why? We know that, as a rule, the Creator is loath to suspend the natural order of things. Miracles are rare and come only to achieve a specific end. How would Rabbi Akiva explain the purpose for such a nature-trouncing feat? Excuse me, let me let Benita in, and Chris just joined us. We're at the bottom half of the first page. As for Rabbi Ishmael's view, it raises the question as to what this verse is coming to tell us in the first place. The Torah has already described the thunder, the shofar blast, the lightning, the fire, and the smoke which accompanied God's descent upon Sinai. Need we be told that the people of Israel saw these sights and heard these sounds? As tools of perception, sight and hearing differ in two significant ways. Sight is a very physical experience. We see the thing itself, its mass, its imminence, the brute fact of its being. Hearing, on the other hand, registers stimuli of a more metaphysical nature. We see a wall, but we hear music, emotional inflections, ideas. This even more so regarding the other meaning of to hear, which is to comprehend in Hebrew. The word shemia means both hearing and comprehension. We hear and understand things that are too ethereal to be captured by the physical eye. A second difference is the manner in which sight and hearing affect us, the extent to which they impress their findings upon our mind and heart. Sight is the most convincing of all faculties. Once we have seen something with our eyes, it is virtually impossible for other sensory evidence or rational proofs to refute what we know, what we now know. Hearing and comprehension, on the other hand, are far less vivid impressors of the information they convey. They will convince us of certain truths, but not as unequivocally as do our eyes. What we hear and understand are facts which have been proven to us. What we see is reality. This difference is also reflected in Torah law. The Talmud rules that a judge who has witnessed a crime cannot sit in judgment over a case. Why not? Is not the entire point of the trial that the judge should learn the truth? Here we have a judge who knows what happened, not through secondhand information received from witnesses, but by the testimony of his own eyes. Explains the Talmud, since he has seen the accused commit the crime, he is incapable of seeing him in the right. A judge must consider more than what the accused did or did not do. He must also examine issues such as intent and culpability. When the judge merely hears from witnesses that the accused committed a criminal act, even if he is convinced that they are telling the truth, he can still maintain the proper distance to objectively consider other facts which may absolve the accused from guilt. But when he himself sees what happened, the fact of the accused criminal deed is not only known, but also real to him, making it extremely difficult for him to override this unequivocal reality with logical considerations. These two differences between sight and hearing are interconnected. We are physical beings inhabiting a physical reality. The physical is real to us, while the conceptual and metaphysical are foreign and insubstantial. So, sight, which perceives physical objects, is definitive and absolute, whereas the intangibles perceived via the ear and mind are at most proven facts, always subject to reassessment and reconsideration. The story is told of a mystic who tells the philosopher, "Do you know the difference between you and me? You are constantly thinking about God, while I am forever thinking about myself." The philosopher was very pleased with the compliment. But one day it dawned on him what the old sage had meant. The philosopher is convinced that he, the thinker, exists and doesn't give it a second thought. So he ponders the existence of God. Does God exist? What is God? How does his existence affect us? To the mystic, however, God is the very essence of reality. But where does that leave us? What possible legitimacy can our finite and transitory existence have within the all-transcending, all-pervading reality of God? The divine truth is given. The mystic ponders his own subjective reality. Do I exist? What significance, if any, is there to my existence? Why do I exist? This is what Rabbi Akiva means when he says that at Sinai we saw what is heard and heard what is seen. Ordinarily, it is our physical existence that is seen and real to us. Of course, we understand that all this has a creator and a purpose. There is proof of it in the majesty and complexity of the universe. Every throb of life bespeaks it, and every stirring of conscience in the soul of man. But this higher reality is merely heard in our world, deduced, sensed, even experienced, but never perceived with the unequivocal realness of sight. To us, reality is the physical. Everything else is merely a concept. But not at Sinai. At Sinai, our eyes were opened and we saw the God of Israel. We saw what is heard, what is ordinarily abstract and spiritual, and we heard what is seen. Our formidable world, so real and tangible, was suddenly a distant echo, a concept. For if God is reality, if the essence of existence is the infinite and omnipresent divine truth, what is our world? Just an illusion? But no, there must be a world. Otherwise, what is the significance of creation? Of the Torah and its commandments. All this tells us that our world does exist. It proves it to us. What is ordinarily a given is now a substantiated theory. But Rabbi Ishmael disagrees. As he sees it, the revelation at Sinai did not come to turn our natural reality upside down. The function of Torah is not to overwhelm and negate the world, but to enable us to deal with it on its own terms and uncover its potential to reflect the goodness and perfection of its creator. This, maintains Rabbi Ishmael, is an even greater miracle than for the material reality to evaporate the moment God introduces himself. That would be the most obvious and natural thing to happen. But at Sinai, we achieved an even greater feat. We held our ground, brought face to face with the divine. We refused to make this an otherworldly experience, a refutation of our infinite and subjective existence. Instead, we insisted on applying the revelation to our reality. We saw and heard godliness, but on our terms, seeing what is seen and hearing what is heard. The physical remained real, and the spiritual remained abstract, and both were permeated with the wisdom of their divine essence and purpose. The Midrash relates a second difference of opinion between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Ishmael regarding the revelation at Sinai, pertaining to how we respond responded to God's proclamation of the Ten Commandments. The Torah relates that God spoke all these words to say, I am God, your Lord. You shall have no other gods before me. The Midrash is puzzled by the Torah's use of the word lemor to say. What does it mean that God spoke all these words to say? Throughout the Torah, dozens of laws are preceded by the phrase, God spoke to Moses saying, or God spoke to Moses to say. But in those instances, Moses is being instructed to convey those divine directives to the Jewish people. Obviously, more cannot be so interpreted in our case, as all of Israel was present at Sinai. Explains the Midrash, to say means that the people responded to each of the Ten Commandments, affirming their commitment to its observance. What did they say? They say yes to the yeses and no to the noes. This is the opinion of Rabbi Ishmael. Rabbi Akiva says they said yes to the yeses and yes to the noes. The Ten Commandments include positive commandments, such as honor your father and your mother and remember the day of Shabbat, as well as negative commandments or prohibitions such as do not murder and do not steal. According to Rabbi Ishmael, when we heard God proclaim the commandments, we responded, yes, to the positive commandments. Yes, we will do so. And no, to the prohibitions. That is, no, we will not do so. Rabbi Akiva disagrees. According to his understanding of the dialogue between God and us at Sinai, we said yes to each of the positive commandments, and yes, that is, yes, we will obey to the prohibitions. But what is the point of their disagreement? In either case, our response was to declare our readiness to uphold both the positive and negative commandments of God. What difference does it make if we said the word yes or the word no, if the meaning of both these responses is the same? There are two ways of relating to the divine commandments in the Torah. One approach is to view them through the lens of human experience, to appreciate the wisdom gained from Torah study. The spiritual elevation achieved by prayer, the tranquility experienced on Shabbat, the educational potential of a Passover Seder, the social value of charity. On the negative side, we can appreciate the importance of the mitzvot that prohibit theft, gossip, promiscuity, food harmful to the body and psyche, and so on. Indeed, our sages have said that the mitzvot were given in order to refine humanity. But is any of this truly relevant? After all, these are God's commandments. What greater achievement can there possibly be than to carry out God's will? From this perspective, all mitzvot are equal, for all else pales to insignificance before this one monumental fact. In the words of Rabbi Schnorr Zalman of Liadi, had we been commanded to chop wood, this would be no less a mitzvah than the most enlightening, fulfilling, and character-refining of God's commandments. This is why Rabbi Akiva maintains that we responded yes to the positive commandments and yes to the prohibitions. At Sinai, Rabbi Akiva is saying there was no such thing as a negative mitzvah. Indeed, one who views the mitzvot in terms of their beneficial effects on their personal life and on society will distinguish between the positive commandments and the prohibitions. To give $1 million to charity is to do something. But what is accomplished by refraining from eating non-kosher foods? To eat that cheeseburger would be detrimental to one's spiritual health. But to not eat it is to do nothing. But at Sinai, says Rabbi Akiva, we were beyond all that. We see what is heard and heard what is seen. The material world with its issues and pretensions for significance was but a figment of the imagination. Reality was God. From such a vantage point, who would think of God's expressed will in terms of moral and social utility? To one who stands at Sinai, says Rabbi Akiva, the definition of mitzvah is an opportunity to fulfill God's will. Nothing else, everything else is secondary. Hearable significance. When you give $1 million to charity, you are doing something. You are fulfilling God's will. When you refrain from eating a forbidden food, you are doing something. You are fulfilling God's will. Every mitzvah is a positive act. And the same positive act, the ultimate positive act, the implementation of a divine desire. Every mitzvah elicits the same positive response. Yes, we will. Rabbi Ishmael disagrees. Assembled at Sinai, we obviously knew that the ultimate significance of the mitzvah is that it is God's will. But we knew this is a sublime truth as a concept that is heard and understood but remains beyond our tangible grasp. Our reality was the physical existence, and the point of revelation at Sinai was not to overturn our perspective but to perfect the one we had. What was real to us, what we saw, was the way in which the mitzvah sanctify our everyday lives and create a world that is at peace with itself and its creator. So there are differences between mitzvot, most significantly the difference between do and don't, as befits dealing with a world polarized by good and evil. There are mitzvot with which we develop the positive in our world, and those which guide us in the rejection of the negative. Mitzvot which cultivate the light, and mitzvot which combat the darkness. At Sinai, says Rabbi Ishmael, we heard what is heard and saw what is seen. Truly, we understand that the essence of a mitzvah is beyond anything our infinite physical selves can relate to. But our primary response to God's commandments was to embrace them as the foundations of our lives, lives defined by the yes and no of our reality. Right? So this is an interesting discussion regarding the revelation of the Torah at Mount Sinai and the extent to which it impacts our reality, or should impact our reality, regarding the nature of God, the nature of man, how we understand those things in terms of our own application of these principles. So we're going to talk about a few details, and then we can have a discussion on some of these issues. By the way, here is an example, in my opinion, of a difference of opinion that facilitates a discussion regarding what the revelation of Sinai is really about, right? So these differences kind of inspire us to talk about them in a way that helps us to apply these principles to our lives. So the differences between the view of Akiva and Ishmael are they're beneficial. They help us to kind of come to terms with what is actually being said and why. At any rate, one of the comments that is made early on in this argument is that sight is the most convincing of faculties. Once we have seen something with our own eyes, it is virtually impossible for other sensory evidence or rational proofs to refute what we now know. So one of the examples of this is in Exodus chapter 3. There the angel of the Lord appeared to Moses in flames of fire from within the bush. Notice it says Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up, right? This was something that Moses saw. He perceived it. He accepted it. He recognized that it was an anomaly. And because it was an anomaly, he thought to himself, I will go over and see this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up. Right? So for Moses, it represented a contradiction in terms. I assume that all of you have seen pictures of the forest fires that have ravaged California recently, right? You know, one of the tragic aspects of the forest fire is that when a tree burns, it does burn up. Right? Houses, when they burn up. Right? And unless there is something done to keep the house from being completely consumed or the forest from being, you know, almost nearly completely consumed, right? This is a great strange sight. This bush is burning, but it's not burning up. It's not going anywhere. And the Lord, when God saw that Moses had gone over to look, that he had drawn close to the tree or to the bush to see what was actually going on, God calls to him from the bush and says, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, Hineni, here I am. By the way, notice that it's the angel of the Lord who appears to Moses in flames of fire, but it's the Lord God who calls to him from the bush, right? The word Lord is the tetragrammaton, the Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, and the word God is Elohim. But the angel of the Lord is the one who appears to him, right? The angel of the Lord is a manifestation of God's presence, a physical, visible manifestation of God's presence in this reality. Another passage which is interesting is in 2 Kings. When the servant of the man of God got up and went out early the next morning, an army of horses and chariots had surrounded the city. Oh no, my lord, what shall we do? The servant asked. Don't be afraid, the prophet answered. Those who are with us are more than those who are with them. And Elijah prayed, open his eyes, Lord, so that he may see. Then the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he looked, and he saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elijah. Now, it's interesting, because the servant didn't see that the hills were full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elijah. So, that apparently should have meant that they didn't exist. What's interesting is that Elijah does see them. But of course, they are not things to be seen. In other words, the hills full of horses and chariots of fire, they're not a part of this reality. So it isn't a big surprise that the servant didn't see them. It is a bit of a surprise that Elisha does see them. He can be aware of their presence, but describing it this way, that when the servant's eyes were opened, he looked and saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. You know, he recognized his master's sense of what was going on. As the enemy came down towards him, Elijah prayed to the Lord, strike this enemy with blindness. So he struck them with blindness, as Elijah had asked. Elijah told them, this is not the road, and this is not the city. Follow me, and I will lead you to the man you are looking for. And he led them to Samaria. After they entered the city, Elijah said, Lord, open the eyes of these men so that they can see. Then the Lord opened their eyes, and they looked. And there they were, inside Samaria. When the king of Israel saw them, he asked Elijah, shall I kill them, my father, my master? Shall I kill them? Do not kill them, he answered. Would you kill those you have captured with your own sword or bow? Set food and water before them, so that they may eat and drink, and then go back to their master. So he prepared a feast for them, and after they had finished eating and drinking, he sent them away. And they returned to their master, so the bands from Aram stopped raiding Israel's territory. Right? So it was a result of this kindness that the heart of the king of Aram was changed, and they stopped raiding the territory of the northern 10 tribes. Okay? If you look at this passage in Luke 24, as they approached the village to which they were going, Yeshua continued on as if he was going farther. But they urged him strongly, stay with us, for it is nearly evening. So he went in to stay with them. When he was at the table with them, he took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and began to give it to them. By the way, here's an instance in which Yeshua, does give thanks as the loaves of bread are broken. And I've mentioned before that this is an invention of the Pharisees. The Pharisees are the ones who cultivated this practice of blessing God, thanking God for the food which we eat before we eat it. And, of course, we do something similar afterwards. But it goes on to say in verse 31, then their eyes were opened and they recognized him. And then he disappeared from their sight. And they asked each other, were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road? So this passage obviously is the event associated with the road to Emmaus, when Yeshua accompanies these two disciples to Emmaus, right? And he turns aside with them, but they don't recognize him when he is talking with them. They have a sense, an internal sense, that something is unique, that something is going on, but they don't clearly come to terms with it until the Lord opens their eyes and they see. And Paul makes an interesting comment in 2 Corinthians, for our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. It would be nice if this was something which were easier to appreciate. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So, in verse 18, we fix our eyes. Notice what Paul says, not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. Since what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. Now, what's interesting, of course, is Paul wrote this about, 60 years, 70 years before Akiva mentions his observation regarding the receiving of the Torah at Mount Sinai, right? So Paul says we fix our eyes on what is not on what is seen. How can we fix our eyes on what is not seen, on what is unseen? How can we see with our eyes what is unseen? Right? Obviously, he's not talking about seeing it. He's talking about contemplating it, understanding it, appreciating it, right? Apprehending it. In other words, so we fix our eyes on what cannot be apprehended, right? In other words, what is seen, but on what is unseen. So it is similar in some ways to what Akiva says regarding the nature of the revelation at Mount Sinai. The revelation from God at Mount Sinai, it changes how we understand the material world, right? And we come to recognize that the material world, everything that we see, is temporary, but it's what is unseen that is eternal, right? That was the point of Akiva's observation, that it's what is unseen that is eternal. The nature, you know, God is eternal. And, you know, he is the one who has given us these instructions, so we have the obligation to follow them and to walk in his ways. This is an incredibly interesting comment on Paul's part here in 2 Corinthians 4. Something else that I came across was this article by Rebbetzin and Miriam Gross. In last week's article, I noted the harm in making hasty conclusions. She writes, "Our senses are fallible and can easily mislead us. A human being, by definition, is apt to err, and therefore should never rush to pass judgment. Let me illustrate my point with an example. I was present at a Sheva Berachot, at which a young man delivered a speech. The Sheva Berachot, or Brachot, are seven blessings recited over a glass of wine during a wedding ceremony." So she was present at a wedding ceremony where a young man delivered a speech in association with these seven blessings. Later, a woman sitting next to me asked me whether I knew who the old man who had given the Devar Torah was, the speech. I replied that the talk had been given by the young man seated next to the older one she was pointing to. I knew it was him, not only because I had seen him give the Devar Torah, but because I asked him later to clarify a point he had made, which he did. But she would not be dissuaded. She insisted the orator was none other than the old man. I didn't pursue it. After all, what difference does it make? But I savored the precious lesson that had fallen into my lap. How often do we stubbornly hold on to mistaken impressions, convinced we're right, our mind refusing to let go of our conclusions, which is an interesting way of applying this whole emphasis on sight and the reality of what it is that we actually see, because sometimes it's possible to think we saw something that we didn't, right? Which is why there are passages in the scripture and in the rabbinic literature too which talk about not trusting the sight of our eyes, right? And in this case, this particular woman didn't, right? She confirmed that what she saw was true by talking to the person who gave the speech. And she asked him to clarify a point he made during the speech, which he does, right? Number two, a judge must consider more than what the accused did or did not do. He must also examine issues such as intent and culpability. When the judge merely hears from witnesses that the accused committed a criminal act, even if he is convinced that they are telling the truth, he can still maintain the proper distance to objectively consider other factors which may absolve the accused from guilt. But when he himself sees what happened, the fact of the accused criminal deed is not only known but also real to him. making it extremely difficult for him to override this unequivocal reality with logical considerations. This passage that follows from Matthew 26 speaks to this issue. While Yeshua was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, arrived. With him was a large crowd armed with swords and clubs, sent from the chief priests and the elders of the people. In that hour, Yeshua said to the crowd, "Am I leading a rebellion that you have come out with swords and clubs to capture me? Every day I sat in the temple courts teaching, and you did not arrest me. But this has all taken place that the writings of the prophets may be fulfilled." Then all the disciples deserted him and left. Those who had arrested Yeshua took him to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the teachers of the law and the elders had assembled. The chief priests, and notice it says the whole Sanhedrin, were looking for false evidence against Yeshua so that they could put him to death. But in Hebrew, the word whole Sanhedrin doesn't refer to the complete great Sanhedrin. It can, but it doesn't have to. The whole Sanhedrin is a reference to the entirety of the group that had assembled. That's the whole Sanhedrin. So this is not a reference to the seating of the great Sanhedrin. Yeshua was not tried before the great Sanhedrin. And sadly, that is something that is often said in commentary, but does not happen to be the case. But they did not find any, though many false witnesses came forward. Finally, two came forward and declared, "This fellow said, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days.'" Then the high priest stood up and said to Yeshua, "Are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you?" But Yeshua remained silent. The high priest said to him, "I charge you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God." And in verse 64, Yeshua says, in a very Jewish way, in a very Hebrew way, "Yes, I am." Now, that's not what the words are, but that was his response. "Tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God." "Yes, I am." Right? So, the high priest asks him a direct question. He provides as direct an answer as it's possible to provide in Hebrew, but the high priest ignores his response. Yeshua says, "You have said so," Yeshua replied, "but I say to all of you, from now on, you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." Right? So, if that is not a yes in the strongest possible language, I'm not sure what is. Because the reference to the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven is a direct quote from a passage in Daniel 7 that talks about the coming of the Messiah with power and great glory. Then the high priest embraced Yeshua as the Messiah. Is that what it says? No. Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, "He has spoken blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? Look, now you have heard the blasphemy. What do you think? He is worthy to death." The others that had been gathered together respond. Then they spit on his face and struck him with their fists. Others slapped him and said, "Prophesy to us, Messiah." Who hit you? So here's an interesting text that describes seeing but not seeing as well. At Sinai, our eyes were open, number 3, and we saw the God of Israel. There are many passages that address this, this issue regarding God, the nature of God, the form of God. If you look at this passage in Exodus 24, Moses, Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and the 70 elders of Israel went up. And notice it says that they saw the God of Israel. Under his feet was something like pavement made of lapis lazuli, a deep, rich, dark purple, a bluish purple, as bright blue as the sky. But God did not raise his hands against these leaders of Israel. They saw God, and they ate and drank. And of course, you're familiar with this passage in Exodus 33, where Moses asks God to show him his glory, and God says, I can't show you my glory. You can't see my glory and live. So he shows Moses his back, not his front, not his face, but his back, right? Now, did the elders in Exodus 24 see the glory of God? No. Otherwise, they wouldn't have survived the encounter either, right? That's what God tells Moses. So what did they see? They saw a form of God, a manifested presence of God, right? A manifested presence of God. And in addition to seeing a form, they saw under his feet a pavement made of lapis lazuli, or that's what it appeared to be. But the point is that God manifests his presence to his people physically and visibly in this world on many occasions. So I'm not sure exactly why the Lord's manifestation of himself in Messiah, right, should be such a difficult issue. Number four, and this is kind of an interesting observation. He speaks about the Ten Commandments, including positive commandments, such as honor your father and your mother, and the other commandments, the negative commandments, and the difference, right, between Akiva and Ishmael. Akiva said that we respond yes to the positive commandments and yes to the negative commandments, that we should think of the negative commandments as positive commandments too. Essentially, they have a positive implication, right? Even though they're negative commandments that prohibit us from doing something, they have a positive impact in our lives. Rabbi Ishmael takes them more directly. We say yes to the positive commandments and no to the negative commandments. Yes, we will do what the positive commandments require, and no, we will not do what the negative commandments require. There's a passage in Matthew 5 that is often described differently. But again, Yeshua said, you have heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not break your oath, but fulfill to the Lord the vows you have made. And there are several passages that refer to this. But I tell you, do not swear an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is God's throne, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make even one hair white or black. All you need to say is simply yes or no. Anything beyond this comes from the evil one. Now, the problem with the NIV translation here is that it doesn't capture the Hebrew idiom. The NIV is a dynamic translation that tries to capture the significance of the idiom, and you can decide if whether or not it gets it correctly. Because in all of these other translations, Yeshua says, all you need to say, or, but let your yes be yes, and your no, no. Right? There's an interesting midrash related to this. Rabbi Ishmael commented, the word saying teaches us that they, the children of Israel, responded to each positive commandment, mitzvah aseh, with the positive affirmation, hen, yes. And to each negative commandment, mitzvah al ta'aseh, with the negative affirmation, lav, which means no. Melamad Shehayu Omrim Al Hen Hen Be'al Lav Lav, right? You don't even have to know Hebrew to appreciate what this is saying. Melamad Shehayu Omrim Al Hen Hen, yes, yes, Be'al Lav Lav, right? No, no. Literally, this teaches that they were saying yes, yes, and no, no. That is, they were responding to a yes commandment, yes, and to a no commandment, no. Right? So, what is Yeshua referring to? Is he referring to the same issue when he says, let your yes be yes and your no be no? Is he saying that our response to a positive commandment should be yes and our response to a negative commandment should be no? Right? This is further addressed in a couple of other passages, brief passages. In James 5, above all, my brothers, do not swear, not by heaven or by earth or by anything else. Let your yes be yes and your no, no, or you will be condemned. Now, for some reason, the NIV, I don't know, Keith dropped out. For some reason, the NIV captures this idiom properly and doesn't translate it dynamically. In other words, it could say, you know, let your statement, you know, let your, you know, let your, how does he put it in this passage? All you need to simply say is yes or no, right? But in this passage, they have James saying, let your yes be yes and your no, no, or you will be condemned. Rabbi Huna said in the name of Rabbi Samuel Bar Isaac, the yes of the righteous is yes, and their no is no. And so this comment, too, could have some connection to the concept of positive and negative commandments, as could Yeshua's statement in Matthew 5. If Yeshua's statement in Matthew 5 is a comment regarding the, you know, responding to positive commandments with a yes and negative commandments with a no, right, then this would be another example of many in the scriptures that affirms the veracity and value of the Torah in the lives of God's people. At any rate, I'm going to stop here, and I know the essay was a lengthy one, but I'm curious as to your take on some of the things that we've discussed.
I think this is an interesting dynamic in this lesson today and Parsha study, and it's one that I've been curious about for a long time, something I've taken a look at and considered. And this whole idea from Rabbi Akiva, they saw what is heard and heard what is seen, is it creates a lot of curiosity in me, and it draws me in, because I'm often curious about dynamics that we experience in our life that are, on the surface, they appear as opposite or opposing or in some kind of opposite movement, when in fact they often are a complement to one another. And it takes us sometimes a little while to get below the surface and to appreciate how, you know, left hand, right hand, and how that they work together. And even though they are a mirror image of one another, that they complement and work together. And there's a lot of things, I think, in our life, and certainly a lot of insights, the principles from Torah that kind of highlights that. And I think this is one of those I'm also interested in this article, this comment from the Rebbe Zin, Miriam Gross, and her experience with the individual who was totally convinced that it was the old man who gave the presentation and not the young man. And I know in my life I've had experiences where I was totally convinced I was right, that what I saw was what really happened and what I heard was what was really said. Only later to learn I misunderstood, or I didn't see it right, or it was different from what I perceived. And, you know, that's humiliating when you discover that. You go, wait a minute, what's wrong with me? You know. And so one of the things that I've learned is that there's a little tiny muscle in the middle ear. Every human has this little tiny muscle, and it's called the tensor tympani muscle. And when you and I are stressed, and the way this manifests is going to be, different from individual to individual, but depending on the intensity of the stress or how long it lasts, its duration, or how frequently this particular kind of stress is triggered, when a person is stressed, that tensor tympani muscle will constrict. And like any other muscle, when it constricts, its mass size increases. And that muscle is in the middle ear, and it's adjacent to the optic nerve. And so this muscle has, when it's constricted, it impacts our ability to hear and to hear clearly. And it impacts our sight. And again, this muscle constricts when the body is experiencing stress. And we know that the body experiences stress when either it's in danger or it's not in danger, but it perceives the threat. It's anticipating the threat, or it's imagining the threat. And I know in my personal life, I can often wake up or somewhere in the middle of the day when I'm tired or something is stressing me, that my vision will get blurred. And I also know that when I am particularly stressed, I don't hear things clearly. Melody thinks I'm deaf, or I'm just not paying attention. And I don't want to give her credit for being right, but she probably is. But the truth is that when any of us are particularly stressed, our level of hearing clearly and seeing clearly can, and sometimes is, impacted. And I just find that really interesting in this parsha today.
Yeah.
That, you know, in these different passages we've been looking at, you know, in times, in Elisha's day, people are blind. They can't see it, where others can see, you know, the army, the horses, the chariots. And, you know, it's like we have this mechanism inside of us that is automatically going to be charged when our brain and our body is in danger or it perceives threat. And so when we recognize not only what our capacities are, but how limiting those capacities can be when we are in a stressful situation, when we're overwhelmed, it can lead us. We can become, I don't want to say we're deceived, but we've come to believe something based on what we heard or what we saw that may not be completely accurate, because at the time we were experiencing or we learned it or we were exposed to it, particularly relaxed. We were stressed.
Yeah. Yeah, good. Very good. Would anyone like to respond to Roderick's comment?
Well, Well, something I was thinking about too is perception sometimes will cause you to see things differently. So sometimes we may be seeing something, but you know how sometimes we are convinced of something, and although we actually seeing something that's true, because of what we are perceiving, what's in our mind, sometimes that can sort of cloud our judgment as well, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, a few years ago, Melody bought a Prius, Toyota Prius car. We've never owned one before. And when she bought that, we saw Toyota Priuses everywhere on the highway. It seemed like everybody had one. Because our awareness became attuned to something that we had acquired, and now it caused us to notice it in, you know, everywhere we were looking. That's a human thing. You know, when something comes on our radar, or we become aware of something, or something becomes known to us, it's almost like our brain becomes attuned and we start looking for it. And it's part of what's called our relevancy system. This becomes relevant. Well, you take an individual, perhaps, as an example, who has experienced some kind of abuse, or they have sat for a long time under a teaching that gave them a certain point of view or perspective. And now, when they read the scriptures, when they look at commentaries, everything is seen and understood through that lens, that point of view, because that's what their brain has become attuned to. And it becomes relevant. And so there are ways to change that, and to open up our horizons. But if we're not intentional to study, in the apostolic writings, it refers to being a Berean, those who study the scriptures, who are intent to look into the Torah for themselves, then we can open up our horizons and not be dependent on the relevancy that someone else has instilled into us. I don't know. Did that make any sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Good. Thank you, Keith, Roderick. You know, it's funny. It reminds me of an occasion years ago when I was leading a congregation, and one Shabbat I taught on the subject of the connection between the Torah and the grace of God. You're probably familiar with the fact that in Christian theology, dispensational theology, the law and grace are opposites, right? In biblical times, the Jewish people are saved by observing the Torah, but Christians in the church age are saved by the grace of God. So the Torah isn't something that they necessarily need to have any consideration of, right? So I talked about the connection between the Torah and grace, the fact that they're not opposites, they're complementary, and that the Jewish people aren't saved by observing Torah. They're not saved by having their 8-day old sons circumcised, for example, right? That the people of Israel received the Torah after they were redeemed from Egypt. You know, Abraham is, you know, God makes a covenant with Abraham. The circumcision is a sign of the covenant, but it isn't what facilitates the validity of the covenant, right? I mean, God makes a covenant with him. And that could be said about so much of the scriptures, right? So I went on and I talked about the grace of God and the Torah, and the things, the concepts and the ideas that connect them together, right? And I talked about it from the Hebrew scripture. I talked about it from the apostolic writings. And interestingly enough, after the message, it's my congregation. I hang around and I, talk to people, and there are all kinds of other activities going on. And a woman came up to me afterwards, and she was enraged with what I talked about. And she confronted me quite loudly in the hallway while there was a lot of other people around and a lot of other things going on. And she made a comment to me saying, "I can't believe that you think that we have to observe the Torah in order to be saved." Right? And the irony is that the entire message, I spoke for an hour, and for an hour I talked about the fact that that is not the case. Right? And when she said that to me, I thought to myself, what message did you just listen to? Because it had nothing to do with anything I just said, right? But it kind of connects with what you just said, Roderick, that some people, regardless of what they see or hear, right, they are so attuned to their perspective of something that they misinterpret what is being said to either affirm or deny what it is that they already believe, right? This was probably the most graphic case that I can remember in my experience teaching, where someone charged me with saying the exact opposite of what I actually said. It was remarkable. I think she left and never came back.
This is one of the elements for people who've experienced trauma, particularly individuals who experienced trauma in early childhood, is they come to judge, as an adult, they come to judge certain people, certain situations or environments as a threat, because it was when it was like something in that environment or about those individuals, it's similar to something in their past, in their history.
Right.
And when they have that understanding or they have that perception, the conclusion is you're a threat. Everybody's a threat. All environments are dangerous. And it's a survival mechanism that we all have. And it tends to lean to the negative because of our intention to survive. And when we recognize that about us, I mean, Israel wrestled with this in the wilderness when the Lord said, "Go take the land, I've given it to you." And so 12 spies go into the land, and 10 out of the 12 perceive the land to be dangerous, too dangerous for them to occupy. And even though the Lord says to them what the Lord says, "I've given you this land, I'm going to be with you, though there be giants in the land, you won't need to be afraid. I am with you." They don't hear what Hashem is saying. They're not comprehending because of their own perceptions.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep, our own perceptions can be very deceiving. Keith, did you have a comment?
Yeah, going along with that, Joseph, just real quick, I just wanted to say this because I thought about this with when I first started working in electronics, and my first partner, when I saw him, he had a bunch of tattoos on. So I automatically assumed he was this type of person, but he became my partner because my first time I said, "Oh God, I hope he ain't my partner," and he ended up being my partner. But once I got to know him, he was nothing like I saw him. He was the kindest person, but I let the tattoos cloud my judgment, and I was already seeing something that wasn't true. So I thought about that when Roderick was saying that as well.
Yeah, that's a good observation too. Good, thanks, Keith. Thank you, Roderick. Yeah, Joseph, go ahead.
I was thinking of Roderick on the lighter side, real quick here, about this anger that impairs our hearing and our vision. I have an assistant at work, and I usually, unfortunately, I have to find a way to deal with this. I get upset every day at work. I get upset, and I mentioned to my assistant, I said, I had to find a way to deal with these issues. Excuse me, sorry. I have to find a better way to deal with my issues and not let myself get upset. But, as I get older, I've been very resistant to having my eyes checked and getting glasses. And I know I need glasses. And especially if I don't get a good night's sleep, my eyes are blurry. I can see and I can function, but my eyes are blurry. But now I'm wondering if it's the anger that's making my eyes blurry, and not my old age. I'm still in denial. I'm a little bit in denial about getting older. But anyhow, that's the light side. But getting back to the
probably a combination of both, huh?
A combination of both. There you go. So the subject at hand. I was thinking as Bob was talking and other people were making comments. I was thinking about the. I think it's Isaiah and Psalms, and Yeshua even says about those who have eyes to see but cannot see, and ears to hear but cannot hear. So I think that's kind of, falls in place here. But I'm also reminded, as you were talking, Bob, earlier, about Fiddler on the Roof, Tevye, and when he asks his wife, "Do you love me?"
Yeah.
And maybe she never said the words to him or didn't tell him daily, "I love you, I love you, I love you." But she sings a song back in response to him, "Look at all the things that I do for you and our family." They're all acts of love.
Right.
And those are important. And the words are important, too. I think in any relationship, those are important, the words and the deeds. But she was saying, how can you even ask me if I love you? I've been with you all these years. I've raised your children. I have done this, that, or whatever, all those things. But anyhow, I just wanted to share that, throw that thought.
Yeah, that's a good one. Good one. Thank you. It reminds me of another aspect of the movie Fiddler on the Roof when they're having a discussion about something and somebody turns to Tevye and asks him, "What do you think?" And Tevye says, "Well, he's right." Right. And then somebody else comes up with an opposing viewpoint and Tevye says, "He's right." And, it's like, how can they both be right? And it kind of reminds me of this discussion between Akiva and Ishmael. Which one is right? And my initial response would be to say, yes. Is Akiva right or is Ishmael right? Yes. Because they both have hit on aspects of the revelation which are important, right? So the perspectives, even though their perspectives differ, those differences help us to think through the significance of the Torah and the effort we should undertake to appreciate reality, right, and to see things clearly and truly, and not just on the basis of our fears or our apprehension about something. So, yeah, good. Good discussion. Yeah, Charlene, go ahead.
This made me think about the hearing, seeing, what you, it's hearing the sounds, seeing the sounds and hearing. It made me think about the times when I walk. So I walk a lot. And when I'm walking, there's a part of my walk where I don't listen to anything. There's a part of my walk where I'm listening. But what I find, find sometimes that's really, like, fascinating to me is that there's part when I'm listening to something, it's like I'm there. Like, and I guess it's because understanding is coming or, but I feel like I can see what they're talking about. But I am so unaware of my surroundings. Like, I may have walked 2 miles and not been aware of anything that I saw because I was so in tune to what I was listening to. And usually, you know, it's like a teaching or something. So it's like understanding comes in a way that makes me feel like I can see what they're saying.
Yes.
Like, you know, in me, I can see what they're saying, even though I'm not aware of my surroundings during that whole time.
Yeah, that's a great Hebraism. The idea of seeing what someone is saying, and I agree. I think that's a great way of putting it. Yeah, that expresses the idea that level of appreciation or understanding or our ability to make sense of things sometimes is like that. Yeah, very good. Good. Let's see, there's a comment, a chat from Susanna. I was a bit confused by today's lesson, but it is connected with things. But is it connected with things are not always as they appear. We must see them through the eyes of God and spiritually. So a question about Exodus 18. Did Yitro have a conversion experience after he saw all that Adonai had done for Israel? He was a Midianite priest, so did he start following the God of Israel after that? With regard to the first aspect of your comment, Susanna, I would say that things are not always as they appear, and that's why I think what was discussed today is so important, is because it is important for us to affirm what we see or think we see, as opposed to just assuming that what we see is true, right? In other words, there has to be an affirmation of the truths that we integrate into our hearts and lives. And the things that don't reflect reality, you know, the lies that we are raised with, right? We have to reject them and replace them with the truth. And I think the value of a discussion like today has to do with the balance that it's important for us to maintain between our reality, which is the known world, the known universe, the known community we're connected to, right? The reality associated with waking up, making our bed, having breakfast, going to work, or doing whatever it is that we do, right? Interacting with people coming home at the end of the day, whatever that involves, right? That reality. And the truth that reality really transcends this, our experience, right? That's what I love about that passage from the book of Kings and Elisha, right? I mean, Elisha sees this army approaching. He's not concerned about them at all, right? But of course his servant is. The servant is concerned because he doesn't see the angelic host surrounding that army, right? Elijah's not concerned because he's aware of a reality that transcends this reality. And I think that's an aspect of the way life works that we need to be more attuned to, right? The Word of God and its significance in our lives. That's one of the reasons why I care so deeply about the scripture and how it says things and what it says and how we integrate them into our lives. The other, I think it is generally conceded or agreed that that Jethro does convert to God, and he is impressed with the things that God has accomplished on the part of his people, and it is that which persuades him that God is God, and that the false gods are false. And so, yeah, I would say, I would agree with those views that say that Jethro does convert to God. He is connected with the Lord. And he's another example, like Naaman the leper, right, who comes to believe that the God of Israel is the one God who created the heavens and the earth, right, but, but does not sojourn with the people of Israel. They return to their life with some obvious modifications, but they return to where they're from, and we don't unfortunately know anything else about their relationship with God after that point, because their story ends. So it would be nice to be able to follow them and to find out what happened, but we just don't know. Good. Thanks, Susanna. Anybody else before we go?
Yeah, this is Ed. I just wanted to say I appreciate the challenge of you including the differing views between Rabbi Ishmael and Rabbi Akiva. You've done it a few times, and you've included them, and I've always been, my initial reaction is to want to side with one or the other. And then as we go on, I start to realize that, well, there's another perspective to consider, and I have to practice that in more than just this class, because oftentimes I'll take a side.
Yeah.
And stubbornly stay there when there is another perspective to be seen if you care to look. So, anyway, thank you for including those.
Yeah, I appreciate that comment, Ed. Unfortunately, what you just said about yourself, we could probably say about ourselves too. I would guess that we're all pretty typical that way. But I think there is a good deal of value in appreciating different perspectives, without regarding one of them as evil necessarily. Right? I mean, that's the challenge, particularly these days. Good. Anybody else have a comment before we go?
Sometimes I think that's just the nature of men and women.
That could be.
Wait, I have to tell Roderick, a friend of mine once, she sent her husband to the doctors to have his hearing checked, and the doctor told him his hearing was fine. But his wife said that he never hears her when she talks.
Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, I think there might be something else going on there, right?
Yeah.
You know, another to Charlene's earlier point, there's another movie called Mr. Holland's Opus. It's a movie about a musician who is teaching music at a school, high school, his wife and their child does not have the ability to hear. He's deaf. And somewhere along in the movie, this husband and wife discover that their son cannot hear music, but he can feel it. And they find him one day sitting on top of a speaker of their stereo system, and he's playing music. But they know he can't hear it, but he feels its vibrations, which gives the father an idea, and later he does a concert and he invites the deaf school, the students from the school that their son has been attending, and they use flashing lights that flash, impulsing or pulsating with the rhythm of the music. And then there's someone who is signing the lyrics. And so the students who are all deaf are able to appreciate and enjoy the music without hearing it.
Yeah.
It's a whole different level of reality. And I think sometimes we limit what God might want to say to us, what he might want to do through us, or what he is saying and doing through other people, because it's beyond our range of acceptance of reality, or it's beyond our ability to comprehend. And I'm imagining that in the world to come, the Olam Haba, that we're going to have a greater range of awareness and comprehension of truth and reality than we have in this life.
Absolutely. I would say the same thing, that we tend to discount experiences with which we are not familiar, right? Or a reality with which we are not familiar. Yeah, it's unfortunate. Good. Thanks, Roderick. Charlene? Very good. Ed, appreciate your comments too. Anybody else before we go?
I was just going to say, in reference to what Robin just said, if I'm not mistaken, Beethoven became deaf later in his life, and he still composed music. And I guess he was feeling it and understanding it, so he didn't have to actually hear it to create it or hear it to understand it. Interesting stuff.
Yeah, it is interesting. By the way, that is a great movie, Mr. Holland's Opus, if you have an opportunity to watch it. And that comment regarding Beethoven is kind of remarkable, too. To appreciate that he heard what he was writing, just not with his ears. Right? I mean, you can listen to Beethoven's work and you can't tell the difference between works that were composed while he could hear and works that were composed when he couldn't. Right? I can't tell the difference between them. Good. Anyone else have a comment before we go? Thanks, Ed. Anyone?
Yes, Rabbi. While you're on the subject, I can look at a picture and I'm seeing it visually, but yet it speaks to me. I can stare at it for hours and it's speaking to me. In the same way, I can listen to something, I'm hearing it with my ears, but yet in my mind, in my heart, I can see what the music is, at least to me, saying.
Yeah. That's one of the remarkable aspects of brain activity, for example. If I tell you to imagine, to imagine a red Volkswagen Beetle in your brain, in your mind, you can conjure up the image of it, right? But if I was to cut your head open, I wouldn't find a Volkswagen Beetle in your brain, right? But the image can be incredibly real and touchable, experientially, you can see it, right? That's one of the remarkable things about memory, right? How memories work and how vivid and real they can be, particularly at night when we dream. Right? Dreams can be so remarkably real that when you wake up, it was like you were just there you know, with someone at some place doing a particular thing, right? I mean, the way the brain works is pretty astonishing. Yeah. Good. Thanks, David. Appreciate it. Anybody else before we go?
Rabbi, one more thing, and this is very interesting. It really jumped out at me when it talked about the no commands.
Yeah.
Food harmful to the body and psyche. And I was thinking to myself, God knows, must know a lot more than we do regarding the effect that food has on us, not only physically, but emotionally and mentally. And I guess maybe science is just catching up or finding out.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. I would agree with that. But that has been, you know, but that has been the position of the sages with regard to food for millennia. You know, that food not only, I mean, it doesn't just affect our physical nature. It affects our inner being, our inner nature as well, you know. Which, by the way, would also be impacted by the way we actually eat things, right? What actually happens to the animals that we eat, for example, right? Those things have an effect on us too, right? In other words, have you ever, I don't know if this is something you've ever experienced, I've experienced this, and I've heard many people tell stories that have to do with something like this, where you know, children, get a few chicks, right? They end up with a few chicks during the year, and they watch these chickens grow up and produce eggs, and they eat the eggs, and then there's an occasion when they end up, the chickens are not making any kind of a commotion outside like they typically do, and when they sit down at the dinner table, that's what is being served, the chickens, right? And I've known people who have, you know, who have eaten them without a problem, and other people who did have an issue with eating those chickens because those were chickens that they raised, right, that they had a connection to. So eating the chicken under those circumstances would have had kind of a negative impact on their on themselves, right? I don't know if this is an experience any of you have shared, but you know, the way an animal is taken care of or slaughtered or whatever, I mean, those, you know, those things do have an impact in how it affects us, which is one of the things that the sages say, for example, about the instruction not to take the you know, the young from a mother bird while she's there at the nest, right? I mean, they're supposed to be, many of the sages would say that commandment or instruction is intended to teach us compassion, right? So that we don't strip a mother of her young in her presence in a way that will obviously affect her, right? And it is a testimony to, you know, to the idea that animals have feelings too. And I would say that we are far behind the curve with regard to understanding that as well, right? But yeah, I think that's absolutely true, that that we are affected by the things we eat. Yeah. Good. Thanks, David. Appreciate those comments. Very good. Anyone else before we go? You know, David, I can't help but give this some thought, too. It's interesting. Had God in the book of Leviticus told us not to eat certain animals because they're not good for us, I think we probably would have had an easier time with avoiding those things. But he doesn't. He just says, don't eat these things because they're not for you to eat. You know, there isn't a rationale provided beyond, you know, you are a distinct people. It's one of the curious things about the text that the understanding associated with an instruction is something that comes with our observing the instruction, right? And it tends not to precede the observance. It tends to come with the observance, right? But, that reflects the huge difference between, you know, the Jewish and the Western worldview regarding things like that. Yeah. In the Western world, it's explain to me why it's true and I'll consider it, right? In Hebrew, it's do what I say and you'll come to understand why it's important. Yeah. Very good. Let's see, are there a few more chats too? Or did I get to these? No, good. There's one from Warren. Thanks again, Bob. Hope everyone has a good week. From Susanna, this is an off-topic question, but a concern I have. My niece gave me a guided meditation for sleep. My antenna went up when I read the title that had the word hypnosis in it. I am not saying that some meditations cannot be helpful with visualizations, for example. Is there something I should be wary of? That's a great question. I think guided meditations in order to facilitate sleep can be a good thing. And I don't necessarily think that that people should be should regard hypnosis, for example, necessarily as a bad thing. I think it, for me at least, it depends on who the person doing the hypnosis is, right? In other words, if hypnosis can facilitate getting at some hidden memories that obviously affect one's behavior, then I think that the process can be helpful if it's undertaken with, you know, with a trusted person involved in the process, right? I mean, I think I probably would say that I feel the same way about pop hypnosis as I do about pop Kabbalah, right? That there can be more damage done than good, but I don't think that necessarily is a reflection on the practice itself, but on the way it's practiced, right? So it's just like yoga. I think the exercises can be very helpful, but I don't, but I mean, on the occasions when I've attended a class, a yoga class, it's only been a couple of times in my life, but I ignored the, one of the classes had more of an emphasis on some of the meditative aspects, of yoga, you know, the Oriental or the, yeah, the Oriental meditative practices. And, you know, so it's possible to do the exercises without, you know, without, you know, without meditating on a false god, right? So I think those things are things that we should be wary of. Some of the subtle associations that are often made. And I think it is helpful to be wary of them, but I don't think certain practices should be dismissed, you know, without an honest evaluation of what they actually involve. Right. And there are many things with regard to sleep that can be, I mean, various exercises and meditative procedures that can be very helpful, right? I mean, and there are other things that can be done too, but sleep, as you know, is an incredibly important aspect of our lives, right? It's important that we get good, deep sleep and enough of it to help us keep up with whatever it is going on otherwise. Good. I hope that was helpful, Susanna. Anybody else before we go? Thanks, everyone, from Keith. Great class. Roderick, Shabbat Shalom to all and Shavuot Tov. Yeah, Beth Ann makes a comment, which is, she said, I read in a book about eating kosher that it is a form of worship. And I thought, she says, I thought that was beautiful. And I agree. That is an important idea that, it's kind of one of the, aspects with regard to Jewish thought and Jewish living generally that I can take mundane activities and use them as an expression of worship, you know, to worship to God. From Charlene, thank you. Great lesson. Have a wonderful week, everyone. From Susanna, that's beautiful, Beth Ann. I agree. Paul says we should do everything, including eating, as unto the Lord. Right? Thank you for sharing. And thank you, everyone. Shavuot Tov. Good. From Elaine, thank you. Great study. I really enjoyed the discussion. Good. Very good. Any other comments before we go? Okay. Well, we had snow over the weekend, so I'll be shoveling snow tomorrow, which is, I don't know, I happen to enjoy it as long as there aren't feet of it, you know. As long as it's a few inches, it's fun, but when it's hard and slushy, it's not fun. My neighbor calls it heartache snow, or heart attack snow.
There you go.
This isn't heart attack snow, this is just clean stuff up snow. So it's good. Keep it up to have a good sled ride. I cut somebody off. What was that? Was that you, Elaine, or?
Yeah, I said enjoy, Rabbi.
Yeah, I will. Thank you. God bless you guys. Good to see everybody.
God bless you. Thank you, Rabbi. Great. Thanks.
Shavuot Tov. I look forward to seeing you this week. Bye for now.
Absolutely. Bye. Recording.